guess I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles, this is your Brad Test. As heard on 90.7 FM in LA, 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Oregon Central Coast, 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 88.5 KAKU, the voice of Maui, and coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, on Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, and of course, Radio Sputnik, 5 days a week. This is your broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. As previously planned and promised, we will be joined shortly by Salon's Heather Digby Parton and 2012 GOP presidential candidate Fred Karger for our coverage of the Democratic presidential debate that took place in Iowa on Saturday. But first, moments after we went off the air on Friday, Paris was struck by multiple terrorist attacks that left at least 130 dead and many more wounded and still fighting for their lives today. On Sunday, France responded, reportedly, by carrying out a massive bombing campaign in Raqqa, Syria, targeting ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, or the Islamic State, whatever you prefer to call them, after the group of radical Sunni Muslims claimed responsibility for the horrific attack in Paris late on Friday. In the wake of that attack, just hours after the news broke, anti-war activist and author David Swanson, who has appeared on this show many times, we've often described him as the conscience of the broadcast, he published a short piece in response to the tragedy. And while I'm sure we'll have much more to say about all of this in the coming days, here's what David Swanson wrote in his piece titled, "Non-French War Deaths Matter." We are all France, apparently, though we are never all Lebanon or Syria or Iraq for some reason, or a long, long list of additional places. We are led to believe that U.S. wars are not tolerated and cheered because of the color or culture of the people being bombed and occupied, but let a relatively tiny number of people be murdered in a white, Christian, Western European land with a pro-war government, and suddenly sympathy is the order of the day. This is not just an attack on French people, it is an attack on human decency and all things that we hold dear, says U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham. I'm not sure I hold all the same things dear as the senator, but for the most part, I think he's exactly right, and that sympathy damn well ought to be the order of the day following a horrific mass killing in France. I just think the same should apply to everywhere else on the earth as well. The majority of deaths in all recent wars are civilian. The majority of civilians are not hard to sympathize with once superficial barriers are overcome. Yet the U.S. media never seems to declare deaths in Yemen or Pakistan or Palestine to be attacks on our common humanity. I included, quote, pro-war government as a qualification above because I can recall a time way back in 2003 when I was the one shouting, quote, "We are all France." And pro-war advocates in the United States were demonizing France for its refusal to support a looming and guaranteed to be catastrophic and counterproductive U.S. war. France sympathized with U.S. deaths on 9/11, but counseled sanity, decency, and honesty in response. The U.S. told France to go to hell and renamed French fries in congressional office buildings. Now, 14 years into a global war on terror that reliably produces more terror, France is an enthusiastic invader, plunderer, bomber, and propagator of hateful bigotry. France also sells billions of dollars of weaponry to lovely little bastions of equality and liberty like Saudi Arabia, carefully ignoring Saudi's funding of anti-Western terrorist groups. When U.S. militarism failed to prevent 9/11, I actually thought that would mean reduced militarism. When a Russian plane was recently blown up, I think I imagined for a split second that Russia would learn its lesson and stop repeating U.S. mistakes. When people were just killed in France, I didn't have any time to fantasize about France coming to its senses because a socialist president was already doing his W-on-the-rubble imitation. To all those who have seen these awful things, said François Hollande, I want to say that we are going to lead a war which will be pitiless. Because when terrorists are capable of committing such atrocities, they must be certain that they are facing a determined France, a united France, a France that is together and does not let itself be moved, even if today we express infinite sorrow, he said. The video doesn't look like Bush, and the French word combat doesn't necessarily mean war just because the Washington Post says it does. It can mean fight in some other sense. But what other sense exactly, I'm not sure. Prosecuting anyone responsible would, of course, make perfect sense, but a criminal justice system ought not to be pitiless. It's a war that ought to be pitiless. And it's a war that will guarantee more attacks, and it's a war that France has begun. It is the job of thinking people not to be on the side of the executioners, said Albert Camus. Please go back to thinking, France. We do love you and wish you well and are deeply sorry for U.S. influence against your better tendencies. That's from David Swanson's Non-French War Deaths Matter. David is an author, activist, journalist, radio host. He's director of worldbeyondwar.org. His books include War is a Lie. He blogs at davidswanson.org and warisacrime.org. He also hosts Talk Nation Radio. A short break, and then we'll be back with our coverage of the weekend's Democratic presidential debate in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm Brad Friedman.
Oh, peace train sounding louder. Ride on the peace train. Ooh, ooh. Come on the peace train.
Yeah, come on the peace train. More aspirational bumper music there than anything else, I'm afraid, this week. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us. As I said in the first block there, a difficult day, a difficult weekend, I know, for a lot of people, certainly for us, certainly for the candidates on Saturday, the Democratic candidates who gathered in Des Moines, Iowa, to have their debate in the shadow of the carnage, frankly, from the night before in Paris. Not easy for anyone, but we will press on and try to make sense of what happened in Saturday's primetime debate in Des Moines, Iowa, which, as I say, came just one day after the terror attacks in Paris. And they were adjusted at the last minute to emphasize the attacks and what frontrunner Hillary Clinton, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley would do in response to the threat from the Islamic State, or ISIS, or ISIL, or Daesh, whatever you'd like to call them. But they also talked about domestic issues as well in what I think was a substantive debate that was once again served as a stark contrast, frankly, to the anger and often fact-free commentary seen in the GOP presidential debates to date this cycle. But, of course, much of it was hidden on a Saturday evening by the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, which for some reason scheduled it on a Saturday night. So very few, at least fewer than the other debates to date, actually saw the three top Democratic candidates square off in Des Moines. We'll try to make up for that a little bit, for the DNC's failure, as I see it, by filling you in on at least a bit of what you missed if you didn't watch the debate on Saturday. and maybe even help you understand what happened if you did stay home and watch it on Saturday, just as losers like myself and my guests did, I think, over the weekend. Joining us once again today is our reigning and returning post-debate analysis champion, who has been with us for all of our broadcast post-debate shows so far this year. I think we've had about five or six of them at this point. The great Heather Digby Parton joins us. She is often known simply as Digby from Digby's Hullabaloo. She's also a contributing writer at Salon and the recipient of the 2014 Hillman Foundation Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism. Oh, Heather, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Great to have you here. I know this is like twice in 1 week for you, so my apologies for that. The good news, because we had the Republican debate just a few days ago, but the good news is I don't think there is any debate for like another month. I think it's like mid-December before I'll have to bother you again unless I come up with a with another excuse to do it, which maybe I will. Also joining us is Fred Karger. This is his second time this year with post-debate coverage, although the last one was a Republican debate. Fred Karger is formerly a Republican political consultant himself, as well as a gay rights activist and a 2012 candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. He worked on 9 presidential campaigns, served as a senior consultant to the campaigns of Presidents Ronald Reagan and Gerald Ford. I remember them. After retiring as a California campaign consultant, he worked as an activist on gay rights causes, investigated the Mormon Church and the National Organization for Marriage's collusion to try to pass California's Prop 8 to repeal the state's same-sex marriage law. Fred unsuccessfully ran for that GOP nomination in 2012, but it made him the first openly gay presidential candidate from a major political party in American history. And that story is the subject of the documentary film Fred. Oh, Fred, welcome back to the broadcast.
Hey, thank you, Brad. And hello, Heather. Good to be back on.
It seems only fair, you know, Fred, we've had, other than when you were here for one of the earlier Republican debates, we've had all, let me call them not Democrats, but non-Republicans who have been here to comment on the Republican debate. So it seems only fair to have a Republican here to comment and badmouth, if you wish, all the Democrats as well.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Have at it. Although I still question your Republican credentials. I suspect most of the Republican Party would. They would call you a rhino, I'm guessing. But I still say you're a fine Republican, an old school Republican. But we'll see. As usual, our own Desi Doyen joins us as well today. Hello, Desi.
Hello. Yes, I am here.
She is our producer and managing editor of our Green News Report as well. All right. Before we get started, Heather, please explain your complicated relationship with Bernie Sanders so that we can otherwise be transparent as we like to be here, as transparent as possible, at least.
Okay. I am involved with a political PAC called Blue America PAC, which we support progressive candidates, mostly for the U.S. Congress, mm-hmm. sometimes for the Senate, and almost never for the presidency, although this time we did raise substantial money for Bernie Sanders as part of a draft movement, and we're still collecting money on his behalf for that. I personally, however, am endorsing nobody in this primary because I hate primaries, presidential primaries, and I don't want to get involved. So.
You hate presidential primaries, and I've had you on to comment on every single debate in this primary season?
Well, that's dedication.
I mean, let me put it to you this way. I hate Democratic presidential primaries.
I see.
And I love Republican presidential primaries.
It's just
they're family fights, which are often very vicious and very ugly. When it's your own team, mm-hmm. it can be a very unpleasant undertaking. This time, not so much, I have to say. I don't really think it's that way, but it has been in the past. And, I just assume, as a writer and somebody who sort of follows this stuff with some semblance of objectivity, I hope, I try not to put myself in interject my own needs into the primary process.
I appreciate that. Fred, are you working with any of the campaigns, Republican or otherwise, or are you otherwise supporting any of the Democratic or Republican campaigns at this point?
Well, the candidate I favored chose not to run a few weeks ago, Joe Biden, but I started last spring a super PAC to oppose one of the Republican candidates. It's called Truth Squad 2016, and we are opposing Mike Huckabee, which made a lot more sense in March than it does now, but going to wait and see how things shake out here over the next couple months.
I got you. And were you supporting Joe Biden overall as for president for 2016 or within the Democratic nomination process?
I just liked him of this whole lot that's running on both sides, liked him the best. I certainly think he looks most like a president.
Okay.
But I also think he'd be a good job. All right.
And Desi, I know you're not working for any of the candidates, at least to my knowledge. you have some splaining to do if you are, but have you selected one of the Democrats?
I have selected no candidates, and at this time, I am not working for any candidate, officially or unofficially, in any capacity whatsoever.
Wow, a bunch of people who can't make commitments. I too am supporting no candidate, and I generally never do. I support voters, not candidates, because I think the candidates have enough supporters, but the voters don't. So that's where I am. All right, viewership plummeted for the Saturday's debate compared to the other debate so far this season. AFP said that the second Democratic presidential debate drew 8.5 million viewers. According to CBS, that was about half as many as the Democrats' first debate last month. That number was sharply this weekend's number was sharply down from 16 million people who watched the first one back in October. Although CBS notes that the latest debate was the number one primetime broadcast on Saturday as far as viewer numbers go. Variety said the latest debate was the lowest rated of the six debates so far, but said that it was the first one held on a Saturday. I had previously gotten some of Heather's thoughts on this, but Fred Karger, what are your thoughts? What are the Democrats thinking? You were a political analyst for years. What the hell are the Democrats thinking by scheduling their debates on a Saturday when obviously fewer people are going to stay home and watch them?
Well, call me a conspiracy theorist, but knowing the Clinton operation and her closeness to the DNC and her husband's, I would suggest that this was intentional. They want to keep this down. There have been columns written about that. They want to keep the viewership down and keep, give her less of an opportunity to get attacked and just kind of get through the necessary debate she has to do. She, of course, would just as soon, like any front runner, not have any debates, but she's forced to. So they're doing six, apparently, and they're all not quite in prime time, and that's probably a very smart call on their part.
I don't know if it was so smart. Heather, after the first debate, Hillary Clinton's numbers skyrocketed. Bernie Sanders had been gaining on her big time. That seems to have been stopped for now. Was it smart for the DNC to do what they're doing here?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, just from the perspective, I mean, I know that, Fred's absolutely right. That is, any strategist would say that the smart thing, if you're a front runner, you don't want to put yourself out there and potentially make some horrible error that messes you up. On the other hand, when you had this dynamic this time between the two parties, the Republicans have been getting tremendous numbers. I mean, some of that due to Donald Trump, and mm-hmm. but also just they've got a lot of people in there. There's a lot of action. It's very entertaining. People are tuning in. The Democrats probably need somebody to start listening to what they're saying, too. So I don't know that this really plays well. I do have to point out one thing, though, that 8 million, if that's what they got, is actually about as much as the big debates between Obama and Hillary got back in 2008. So it's not like nobody watched, although comparatively, nobody did. And it was probably mostly, just political junkies that tuned in. But nonetheless, it's not as horrible as it sounds, simply just by comparison to this year, which has shown tremendous interest in these presidential debates.
Well, you're right. I mean, any other year, 8.5 million would have been big numbers. And, compared to those that monster contest back in 2008 between Obama and Hillary, These numbers are still pretty good, but I think it speaks to the fact that the country is, for whatever reason, and maybe it's due thanks to the carnival barker in the Republican side, as Martin O'Malley called him in the debate over the weekend, but for whatever reason, they seem to be interested in the political process. They seem to be interested in the candidates. And why any political party would, want to hide their candidates, and they've got good ones, frankly, as far as Democratic candidates go, why they would want to hide that from the public, I just don't understand. It seems incredibly stupid, but it wouldn't be the first time for the DNC to be incredibly stupid. All right. Well, let's get to some of these since so few people did hear it. I want to get through some of these clips. They started with foreign policy, of course, which, you know, was a change after the attacks in Paris. I'm going to try to run through a few of these clips from a few different candidates. We'll sort of walk through one at a time and get any thoughts that you guys have might have along the way. But I want to play a few longer clips than I usually do just because I don't know how many people actually heard these things prior to today. So let's jump in. This is clip number one. Des, before the attack, Obama had said ISIS was not gaining in strength, according to John Dickerson, the moderator. He asked Hillary Clinton at first here, did the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton, when she worked for them, did they underestimate ISIS?
Hours before the attacks, President Obama said, "I don't think ISIS is gaining strength. Won't the legacy of this administration, which you were a part of, won't that legacy be that it underestimated the threat from ISIS?"
Well, John, I think that we have to look at ISIS as the leading threat of an international terror network. It cannot be contained. It must be defeated. If we summon our resources, both our leadership resources and all of the tools at our disposal, not just military force, which should be used as a last resort, but our diplomacy, our development aid, law enforcement, we will support those who take the fight to ISIS so that we can be supportive. But this cannot be an American fight, although American leadership is essential.
But Secretary Clinton, the question was about, was ISIS underestimated? You missed it in the past.
Well, John, look, I think that what happened when we abided by the agreement that George W. Bush made with the Iraqis to leave by 2011 is that an Iraqi army was left that had been trained and that was prepared to defend Iraq. Unfortunately, Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister, set about decimating it. And then with the revolution against Assad, and I did early on say we needed to try to find a way to train and equip moderates very early so that we would have a better idea of how to deal with Assad, because I thought there would be extremist groups filling the vacuum. So, yes, this has developed. I think that there are many other reasons why it has, in addition to what happened in the region, but I don't think that the United States has the bulk of the responsibility. I really put that on Assad and on the Iraqis and on the region itself.
That was Hillary Clinton on Saturday. Heather Digby Parton, this is obviously going to be a big issue, at least for a while, if these attacks continue. Does noting that so much of what's going on comes out of the Iraq war, comes out of what the Bush administration did, will that work for Hillary Clinton, or are they going to or will the effort to tie her to the rise of ISIS work, you think?
I don't know if it'll work. I don't know if it will work that, you know, she ties it to, you know, the Bush administration. I mean, I don't know whether or not either of those approaches really are adequate. I mean, I think she handled the question fine, you know, considering her position there. I think she showed obviously she's, you know, she was Secretary of State. I mean, she'd been a senator on the Armed Services Committee prior to that. So, you know, she's very, very well versed in this, and probably more so than most of the Republican rivals, save a couple who, you know, seem to be somewhat fluent in this subject. But you know, on a political level, I think this is going to be very interesting, because I think that the Republicans have wanted for some time to shift to national security if they could, because that's traditionally an advantageous playing field, and I think they felt that Clinton had, you know, this is partially what the Benghazi thing is about, right, that she was vulnerable on this subject of terrorism. So I think, she's going to have to be very, she's going to have to handle this very deftly. It's not easy. The president, unfortunately, said the words prior to this attack that we had ISIS contained. Now, specifically, he was referring to, the actual territory that they had seized in the region, not contained as a global terrorist, organization. Mm-hmm. But in this particular way. But because he said those words, of course, that's going to be a very tough thing. And she's going to, be put in a very tough position in terms of how she separates herself from him, but also not too much, because, you can only go so far with that. And she kind of did it in that comment in which she said, "We can't be contained, they must be defeated." Well, that's a typical candidate kind of thing to say. But it was something that was definitely sort of drawing a line between her and President Obama. So
let me ask. I want to get Fred Karger's thoughts on this and what he would do with that as a Republican political consultant. But before I get that, let me play Martin O'Malley. His response to the question about, if U.S. doesn't lead, then who leads? This has been a criticism from the Republicans that the U.S. isn't leading on this issue. Let me play Martin O'Malley's thoughts here, and then, Fred, I'll get your thoughts on both of them.
Okay, Governor O'Malley, would you critique the administration's response to ISIS? If the United States doesn't lead, who leads?
I would disagree with Secretary Clinton respectfully on this score. This actually is America's fight. It cannot solely be America's fight. America is best when we work in collaboration with our allies. America is best when we are actually standing up to evil in this world. And ISIS, make no mistake about it, is an evil in this world. And we do have a role in this, not solely ours, but we must work collaboratively with other nations. The great failing of these last 10 or 15 years, John, has been our failing of human intelligence on the ground. We took out the safe haven in Afghanistan, but now there is undoubtedly a larger safe haven, and we must rise to this occasion in collaboration and with alliances to confront it and invest in the future much better human intelligence so we know what the next steps are.
That was Governor Martin O'Malley speaking on Saturday, and we'll get to Bernie Sanders' thoughts on this momentarily. But Fred Karger, as a former Republican consultant, what would you do with the commentary there from Hillary and or Martin O'Malley? And do you think it will be effective this year?
Well, we're living in a very different and dangerous world, and certainly the Obama/Clinton first 4 years is responsible for some of this turmoil, and I contend that they did pull out too early from Iraq, and I was strongly in favor of that and of removing ourselves from Afghanistan, but we made a lousy deal, and we should not have gone out the way we did. And so she's responsible, and to some extent, and of course her record is, as Secretary of State, needs to be examined. And I would also argue that she did very little other than travel as Secretary of State because she was so cautious, presumably because she had this presidential campaign in mind. As far as Martin O'Malley's comments, I tend to agree more with those. We need to be very vigilant, but we need to be very cautious before we put any boots on the ground again in the Middle East. It's a dangerous situation. We have many allies, particularly Middle East allies, that are really under even more threat, as you mentioned, the bombing in Lebanon. I mean, these become so routine, 43 people killed. And I tweeted about that, how fortunate we are to live in this country the day before the Paris attack. It's so frightening out there. We've been very fortunate here. But we need to assemble, as George H.W. Bush did. I'm just reading his new book. A great coalition to take on ISIS because they are the new threat, and we're going to have some unusual allies in that fight, maybe even Assad and others. But, we have a common enemy now, so we need to destroy that enemy because they are going to, and when you think what they've done just in the last year from just a number of beheadings to terrorizing an entire city and country.
Well, but
and,
Fred,
and they're going to be going to this country next.
Let me press you on this. 2 points. One, you say that we pulled out too early, but of course that was George W. Bush's deal. We would have had to. Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq at the time, did not want to change that deal, despite the fact that Obama did want to stay. How is that fair to blame him for leaving too early when Iraq did not want us there? And two, what would be different? What would you suggest would be different than what Obama has already done as far as leading a coalition? Because they're bombing the crap out of one country after another in the Middle East in response to ISIS right now.
Well, I think that that's just the common blame that Bush had this deal. When a new administration comes in, it was not anything signed in blood, then they have that opportunity to renegotiate. And I contended when I ran that Obama was the world's worst negotiator. He put his cards on the table always in dealing with Israel and the Palestinians. He never knew how to negotiate. And when he pulled out of Iraq, he fell into that category. And he was poorly served by his advisors, and he should have negotiated a much better deal. They just ran us out of this country, which we were responsible for overthrowing and creating this new government. So I still contend that he made a lousy deal. And if we did have some kind of presence there, this whole ISIS threat might be different. But who knows? So I think we need to look forward from here and not necessarily look back and figure out a way to assemble a great coalition, as we did with our allies in World War II, to take out this new threat. Because if they get any kind of nuclear armament, we are really in serious trouble.
Heather, I'll leave that up to you. Would you like to respond to that?
Just briefly, I'll just point out that, you know, the idea of forming the great coalition, I have no reason to believe that the administration isn't trying to do that, but what I see is the right wing of the Republican Party absolutely having fits anytime he even discusses the idea of working with Iran, which would be a logical and very important ally in a fight against ISIS, since they are on the opposite side of ISIS, working with Vladimir Putin, working with Assad. These are all areas, and in fact, over the weekend, when Obama was at the G20, there's a picture that came out of him speaking very closely with Putin and the two translators there, and they were deep in conversation, and it was one tweet after another from various conservatives absolutely appalled and say, this is the most frightening thing I've ever seen. So, you know, this is difficult. It's not just difficult in trying to put that coalition together, because the various strands of Middle Eastern loyalties, religious affiliations, various nationalist concerns, all of that combined with our own domestic issues that go into that. It's not that I disagree with Fred. I think he's absolutely right. I just think it's easier said than done. I mean, I think people underestimate the complexity of that. And as a result, they kind of look at Obama and say, well, why can't he do it? Well, you know, it's just not that easy. And it would certainly be a lot easier if the Republicans in Congress would be a little bit more cooperative and stop, you know, being quite as obstructionist toward anything Obama tries to do.
Well,
I think.
And I would agree with Fred on one level that, yes, and I've written about this since at least 2007, Barack Obama has been a terrible negotiator from the beginning. He's gotten a little bit better, but he's been a terrible negotiator. That said, you know, I don't know how you force a country to keep tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of troops in their country if they don't want you there, if they're not going to give immunity to your troops, and so forth. But I think that this entire issue, the attacks in Paris, would seem to redound in this race at this point to the benefit of Republicans, if only because, you know, they'd much rather talk about foreign policy issues, in their fear-based fashion. And, you know, scaring soccer moms is one way that Republicans are able to reach out to women. But I think they've largely stayed away from it, it seems, because eventually you get to where you were, Fred, where you're talking about troops on the ground, hundreds of thousands of troops on the ground, American lives at risk. And I don't even know that the Republicans want to go there and remind everybody about what happened during the George W. Bush administration and that boots on the ground foreign policy. So, I mean, Does this end well for Republicans if they continue down this same line?
Well, some certainly do. Talk to Lindsey Graham or John McCain, and we've got some real aggressive people in elective office who would like to put troops on the ground.
Yeah, but they're being rejected. Obviously, McCain was already rejected, but Lindsey Graham is being rejected by the electorate. They don't want that heavy, muscular, boots-on-the-ground foreign policy, it seems.
Well, that's not why he's being rejected. He's other reasons, but he has a very strong voice in the U.S. Senate. The Republicans hold the majority, as does John McCain. And they're loggerheads with the president over that. But we do need to get more aggressive, and we're certainly seeing what France did the day, 2 days after they were attacked. They went right in and started taking out, I'm sure with our assistance from our intelligence, taking out ISIS main command. And that's what we need to do. We can't pussyfoot around. This organization, which has grown so strong in so long, and they're very smart. You know, as a public relations guy, I looked at what they did with all these horrific things that got them all this national attention. They were smart, and they recruited off of those beheadings and the fire, you know, burning people alive and those type of horrific, inhumane activities they did. It's good for their recruiting. So they're smart, they're savvy, they know how to use the internet, they know how to use PR and get things done. And the fact that just, in a year, to do a stage, an attack like they did in Paris, went so well as far as they're concerned and did so much damage and just caused this entire uproar in the whole world, that we really need to contain them very quickly.
Let me get Bernie Sanders in because we got to get to a break, but I want to get some of Bernie Sanders' thoughts on all of this and what he sees as Hillary's culpability in this with her vote in favor of the Iraq war.
Well, let me have one area of disagreement with the secretary. I think she said something like the bulk of the responsibility is not ours. Well, in fact, I would argue that the disastrous invasion of Iraq, something that I strongly opposed, has unraveled the region completely and led to the rise of Al-Qaeda and to ISIS.
Senator Sanders, when you say the disastrous vote on Iraq, let's just be clear about what you're saying. Are you making a direct link between her vote for that war and what's happening now for ISIS, just so everybody can be clear at home?
I don't think any sensible person would disagree that the invasion of Iraq led to the massive level of instability we are seeing right now. I think that was one of the worst foreign policy blunders in the modern history of the United States.
I think it's important we put this in historic context. The United States has, unfortunately, been victimized by terrorism going back decades. In the 1980s, it was in Beirut, Lebanon, under President Reagan's administration. We also had attacks on two of our embassies in Tanzania and Kenya when my husband was president. And then, of course, 9/11 happened, which happened before there was an invasion of Iraq. I have said the invasion of Iraq was a mistake, but I think if we're ever going to really tackle the problems posed by jihadi extreme terrorism, we need to understand it and realize that it has antecedents to what happened in Iraq, and we have to continue to be vigilant about it.
Heather Digby Parton, it seems like Hillary's saying that, don't blame me. It wasn't the Iraq war, that this would have happened anyway. Does that work? And does Sanders, calling her out for that, does that work on the Democratic side in this battle just between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders at this point?
Well, it works and it doesn't work. It works in the sense that ISIS would not exist without the invasion of Iraq. That is absolutely clear. That's historically verified that ISIS grew out of the Iraq war. And in fact, some of its main thinking came out of the prison camps that we had in Iraq. And they were, among some of these radicalized Iraqis that were in there.
But we've already established that doesn't seem to make much of a difference to Republican voters. Does it make a difference amongst the Democratic electorate?
I don't know, because she's also right in the sense that 9/11 happened before the invasion of Iraq, and that was a pretty big terrorist attack, and it was Islamic, what's the word that we're supposed to use that Republicans demand we use? Radical Islamism, is that it?
Is that it, Fred?
Is that what we're supposed to use? Is that, I forget. Anyway, yeah. We know that that existed. Islamic terrorists.
There
okay. I'm happy to use whatever term the Republicans force me to use. I'm absolutely fine with that. But it happened before Iraq. So it's not as if this, you know, this concept of Islamic terrorism was invented by the Iraq invasion. The vote to go into Iraq clearly is, you know, one of the, it's the reason she lost the last election.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
You know, I think that plenty of Democrats understand what a horrifically bad judgment she showed in voting for the invasion of Iraq. But in this particular case, when you're talking about, you know, Islamic terrorism and you're talking, I mean, you know, we can go back to the 80s and Reagan and the Afghan War. You know, this is, there's a long, long, long trail of American responsibility and you know, involvement in the creation of that, which, by the way, is something we ought to be thinking about before we start talking about, you know, invading more countries and doing and being involved some more, I think, in the Middle East, because it really has not worked out well for us all the way along. This goes back a very long way. In that sense, she's right. I don't know that Democratic audiences, voters are going to see that, but I don't think that she's wrong in pointing that out. It's not entirely an Iraq-centered issue.
And the other thing, by the way, that hasn't worked out is bombing the crap out of people. Fred mentioned that France, had a huge bombing campaign over the weekend. They did. I guess that continues the, what are we on, 10 or 15 years now of absolutely bombing the crap out of the entire country in Iraq and now more so in Syria and elsewhere. And it only seems to make the bad guys grow stronger rather than what so many Republicans seem to suggest that, oh, if we only bomb them enough, they would go away. I'll let Fred have a response to that if he wants after this break. I got to get to a quick break. I'll also give Fred a chance to take care of that dog in the meantime. We're going to take
that was Heather's dog.
Oh, that was Heather's dog.
It's not my dog.
Oh, there's a wild dog somewhere.
I don't know what
we
doing here.
All right. Well, we'll
the other person.
I'll check. Maybe it's my dog, and I don't even have one. I'll check. Well, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with Heather Digby Parton and Fred Karger and Desi Doyen and myself here on the broadcast. Our coverage of the Democratic debate over the weekend in Des Moines, Iowa will continue. Stay tuned.
Well, John, I come from the 60s, a long time ago.
Is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard. Life used to be so hard. Now everything is easy because of you.
Yep. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Our coverage of the weekend Democratic debate in Des Moines, Iowa, with Salon's Heather Digby Parton and former 2012 Republican presidential candidate Fred Karger is here, a former Republican operative. Is that right? Can we call you an operative?
I love being called an operative.
All right, there you go. Okay, I want to get to some of the social issues here very quickly, if we can. This line I thought was fantastic. Desi Doyen, clip number six, as they were talking about how Bernie will pay for all the things that he has promised, like free public college education and so forth. How high would he be willing to raise taxes?
You've said that to do some of these things, you'll impose a tax on top earners. How high would their rate go in a Sanders administration?
So we pay for this by due demanding that the wealthiest people and the largest corporation who have gotten away with murder for years start paying their fair share.
Well, let's get specific. How high would you go? You've said before you'd go above 50%. How high?
We haven't come up with an exact number yet, but it will not be as high as the number under Dwight D. Eisenhower, which was 90%. But it will be. I'm not that much of a socialist compared to Eisenhower.
That was a pretty great line, I thought. Fred Karger, as maybe an Eisenhower Republican yourself, I don't know, does Does that work? And are Republicans, because I've heard this go back and forth, who would they prefer to see get the nomination here? Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton? Really, who would they prefer to see? Your friends in the Republican Party.
It's a tough one. I think they're both very vulnerable. Hillary, of course, it's going to be a roller coaster ride for her. She was inevitable 8 years ago and looking a little more inevitable a week ago, and now that's changing a little bit. So I think either one. And, of course, we have a pretty weak field in the Republican side, and it's going to, you're going to have to hold our nose and vote for somebody next November, but we just don't know whom yet.
Heather, your thoughts on that same question?
Oh, I think they'd much rather run against Bernie Sanders, not because Hillary is such a strong candidate, but just because he is, he's literally claimed the socialist label, and I just think that's just too juicy of a target for the Republican Party. I think they'd rather run against him, and I don't know that they'd do any better against him than they do against Clinton. I mean, they both have their good and their bad sides, but that's my feeling. I mean, the fact that they push him so hard tells me that they'd really like to run, at least on my Twitter feed.
Yeah.
Tells me that they'd really like to run against Bernie if they could.
I think that's the old don't throw me in the briar patch thing. I think they know how to run against Hillary Clinton. I think they have no clue how to actually run against Bernie Sanders and what effect he will have. So I'm not sure if I buy that feint that Republicans offer. Oh, please, please give us the socialist Bernie Sanders. Let's go into this clip number 9, Desi. The question about Hillary Clinton's support from Wall Street, huge support from Wall Street, and Bernie Sanders, who does not take money, at least the super PAC money like that.
Why, over her political career, has Wall Street been the major campaign contributor to Hillary Clinton? Now, maybe they're dumb and they don't know what they're going to get, but I don't think so. It ain't complicated. You got 6 financial institutions today that have assets of 56%, equivalent to 56% of the GDP in America. They issue 2/3 of the credit cards and 1/3 of the mortgages. If Teddy Roosevelt, a good Republican, were alive today, you know what he'd say? Break them up. I will break up these banks, support community banks and credit unions. That's the future of banking in America.
You said they know what they're going to get. Look, what are they going to get?
Well, why do they make millions of dollars of campaign contributions? They expect to get something. Everybody knows that.
Before I ask for your thoughts, Heather and Fred, let me play Hillary's response. Her reason why it is that Wall Street is giving her so much money, it is because they are so thankful that she helped them out, I guess, after 9/11.
He has basically used his answer to impugn my integrity. Let's be frank here. Oh, wait a minute, Senator. You know, not only do I have hundreds of thousands of donors, most of them small, and I'm very proud that for the first time, a majority of my donors are women, 60%. I represented New York on 9/11. When we were attacked, where were we attacked? We were attacked in downtown Manhattan, where Wall Street is. I did spend a whole lot of time and effort helping them rebuild. That was good for New York, it was good for the economy, and it was a way to rebuke the terrorists who had attacked our country. So, it's fine for you to say what you're going to say, but I look very carefully at your proposal. Reinstating Glass-Steagall is a part of what very well could help, but it is nowhere near enough. My proposal is tougher, more effective, and more comprehensive because I go after all of Wall Street, not just the big banks.
John, please.
Okay, so there you go. Which of you two would like to have it that first?
Go first.
All right, go get him.
Get it out of the way.
Go get him.
All right. First of all, Sanders, he's totally right. He's completely right. Of course, Clinton is, accepting, donations from Wall Street. They expect something in return. And the fact that she said that thing about 9/11, it was just obnoxious. I mean, let's just face it. That's just an obnoxiously weird thing for her to say. I can't even imagine that she believes it, but whatever. The idea of that is absurd. she has throughout her career been associated, you know, she was part of the DLC. She goes all the way back into this time when the Democrats decided that they needed to become, you know, quote, market friendly, and they needed to, access the big money on mm-hmm. Wall Street. And it is true. She has to get money from somewhere. I mean, that's absolutely a fact. The Republicans are awash in money. They are drowning in money. It's a gusher of money. So the Democrats do have to get their money from somewhere. But the idea that she did it, you know, that the reason they're giving it to her is because she was, I don't know what, down at the Red Cross, you know, giving blood or something. I don't even know what it was she's talking about. Was ridiculous, and it was really the low point for her in the debate, and it's going to cost her big because that is a ridiculous thing to say. And if the Democrats, I'm sure Bernie Sanders is never going to let her forget it. Mm. Most progressives are never going to let her forget it, and I'm sure the Republicans aren't going to let her forget it. So.
Well, she, Fred, your thought? She was, I mean, playing the 9/11 card. That was really a Republican move, it seemed to me. Just citing 9/11. Hey, don't beat me up, cause 9/11. Your thoughts, Fred Karger?
Well, yeah, I saw it as from a consultant's point of view. I'm sure in her rehearsals for these debates, they've always advised her to play the woman card and the 9/11 card. Things start to go south, just throw those in. Well, she used some poor judgment, I think, in playing both in this instance to try and divert the attention. Don't forget, as Bill Clinton's presidency, as we look back on it, he had a lot of Wall Streeters in key posts at mm-hmm. Treasury and everywhere else. So they have a very cozy relationship, and they're the masters at fundraising. We've certainly seen that with the foundation for their campaigns. She's much more successful than the Republicans running, with the exception of Jeb Bush initially, but now she's surpassed everybody. So,
well, Fred, though,
they're having
that
trouble raising money.
That was a different time, it seems to me, when Bill Clinton had all of the Wall Streeters in the cabinet. Isn't the American public, frankly, both the Democratic and the Republican side, kind of sick of that, kind of sick of the control that Wall Street has? Or is it still, there's a few people on the margins of each party who are bothered by it, but by and large, the public just doesn't care?
Look at the support she's getting. That's mostly from Democratic mm-hmm. financial types from Wall Street and all over the country. So, no, it's a kind of like, it's not Hollywood where it's one party or the other. It's pretty well diverse, and you have people on both sides. The one thing I like about the Wall Streeters and the financial community, when they are Republicans, they tend to be very much more moderate and less concerned with the social issues. So they tend to support the more moderate, sensible Republican candidates. So as far as that goes, I think that's a good thing. But everybody gets in this business. It's a $2,700 maximum to a campaign you can give in a primary, and then they don't take matching funds again for the general. So we're not talking about creating a huge amount of influence. It's the way the system works. The problems I have are with these super PACs and some of the hidden money that we are seeing with the 527s and mm-hmm. some of the other loopholes that have been set up, and a very weak and cowardly Federal Election Commission, which is, of course, divided right down the middle, 3-3 in the commissioners, so they don't do anything, which is the way the federal government likes it. But yeah. we need transparency in campaign reporting and politics, and we need to crack down on a lot of the abuse that's happening right now.
And I agree with you, of course, about the FEC. I think I put more weight on the money that, yes, there are some campaign limits on what they can give to her campaign directly, but that money going to her super PACs, she knows where that money is coming from, and it's Wall Street. We have about 30 seconds each for you here. Heather, do you agree? Was this a substantive debate? And finally, will it have moved the needle in one direction or another?
I don't think it moved the needle. I think, judging from the snap polls that came out afterwards, it appears to just sort of, it's a status quo. Nothing particularly changed it. I do think, and I just think it's important to point this out, that, you know, everybody was so impressed with John Dickerson that he ran this wonderful debate, mm-hmm. that he gave these great questions, and it was just a terrific, and the entire press corps was patting themselves on the back for what a wonderful, wonderful job he did. And nobody pointed out that part of the reason why that debate went well, and it was substantive, was because none of the candidates stood there and had a temper tantrum over having hard questions posed to them. So I would just say that, you know, let's give the candidates a little bit of credit here for acting like adults and, you know, taking the questions. And they were tough, and they were substantive, and they took them, and they didn't, you know, whine and cry about it. So,
Fred, good points all. Fred, your thoughts. Will it move the needle, and was it a worthwhile debate?
No. I think all debates are worthwhile, but I think people are really starting to finalize their choices, and we're not seeing a lot of vacillation on the Democratic side. The Republican side is wide open. What I'm fearful of is the Donald Trump factor, and that he and some of his fellow Republicans have really gone after the media for their gotcha questions, as they call them. Well, that's what debates are for. So if you're going to just have softball questions at debates, and I think even the folks at CBS were a little intimidated. They don't want to lose these because, as you pointed out early in the broadcast, Brad, mm-hmm. these are rating bonanzas,
yeah.
particularly the Republican side. So now you've got the media backing away from their aggressive questioning of the candidates because they're afraid that some of these candidates might just tell them to take a hike and they won't come back on their debates, and all it takes is one for these things to crumble. So that's one of the fears I have moving forward, and I just hope that the press will hang tough and ask those type of tough questions that we want to see and want to test the candidates on.
And I will agree with you there. My thanks. And Desi Doyen, I will get your thoughts in our upcoming
yeah.
show, because we didn't even get to the issue of the point that they didn't ask about climate change.
They didn't ask about climate change. Yeah. They didn't ask about energy policy. They didn't ask about campaign finance reform, which is closely tied to all of these very important issues.
Which seems an oversight. We'll pick that up in our next thrilling episode, although it may be because of the last minute adjustment due to Paris and so forth. But there's a lot to talk about there. So, Des, since you'll be around, we'll talk to you about that in upcoming broadcasts. I want to thank Desi Doyen, our producer, and our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn. And of course, my thanks to my guest today, Heather Digby Parton, who you can and should follow on the Twitters at Digby56. And Fred Karger, who you can and should follow on the Twitters as well, at Fred Karger. And I believe also FredKarger.com. Is that right, Fred?
Either one. But I could use some Twitter followers. So
there you go.
Fred Karger at Twitter.
There you go.
Fred Karger.
That's it. Perfect. Thank you, Fred. Always great to talk to you, sir. And my thanks to you as well, Heather Digby Parton. Check out her work as ever at Salon and at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Thanks very much.
You bet. If you missed any portion of our program today, download it at bradblog.com. Follow us on the Twitters at TheBradBlog. And, of course, drop us email. IamBradcast@bradblog.com. All right. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.